when I began to meet people personally who had conditions that were helped by cannabis, that's what really fired my determination and my passion.
Welcome to the Cannabis Health Magazine podcast, What's Your Why? My name is Hannah Deacon and I'm joined today with Professor Mike Barnes, and we will be discovering the reason why people we're speaking to have such an interest in cannabis. What motivates them? Who were they before they came into this industry? How do they think things could work better for patients? We're taking an in-depth look into what makes these people tick with an informal conversation which won't focus on graphs and commercial outlooks, but what drives them and why cannabis and the part they are playing in the UK really matters to them.
And I'm Mike Barnes. Thank you for joining us. And today we have Peter Reynolds. Now, Peter's one of the best known cannabis campaigners in the country, if not in Europe, because you've been doing it really. The people in this industry who've been doing it 18 months and they think they're really old hands. You've been doing this for, tell us, over 30 years, Peter?
Well, over 30 years, yes.
Yeah. I mean, how did it start? Go back 30 plus years and tell us what got you into this space.
Well, I'll go back 50 years, really.
Okay.
When my great friend John Pooler, who used to go to Merchant Taylor's Public School, I went to the lowly Rickmansworth Grammar School. We used to meet on the way home from school at the end of the footpath that went down to his house. And one particular day, we'd been plotting it in advance, he said to me, "I've got it! I've got it!" And he held it up, and it was this little piece of black hash. And half an hour later, we were in his bedroom with an LP cover. It was probably a Bob Dylan album or a Stones album or a Grateful Dead album, rolling up our first joint. And 10 minutes after that, I was being violently sick into a coffee cup. As this was the age
great
of about
start.
14, absolutely, the age of about 14, I think. And that was the start of my cannabis career, if you like. And I quickly became very fond of it. In those days, John and I and other friends were part of a band. I mean, I know this sounds like a story of everybody's life, if you like, but we were part of a band. You know, I was Eric Clapton, Rick was Bob Dylan, you know.
Fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. And we used to, you know, trawl around playing little gigs in pubs and things. And I loved cannabis, you know. Particularly, I suppose, because I found it enhanced music enormously, like so many people. You know, I've laid on the bed in my bedroom with my record player going, listening to Santana or the Stones and thinking, wow, you know, seeing music turn into colours before my eyes. And so I suppose I was always quite an opinionated person, even at that age, and I was just outraged at this thing that I was getting so much pleasure out of, and I felt enhanced my life so much. My personal freedom was the law attempted to try and prevent me doing this. And I quite quickly after that got involved in, I used to write letters. You know, I think I did an interview once on a student radio station back here, you know, when I was a teenager. And then eventually, after we'd done our O-levels, about eight of us all went off to Amsterdam. And we spent the summer in Amsterdam, sleeping in Vondelpark in the day. This was 74, I think it was, in the days when you were actually allowed to. And I didn't just experiment with cannabis there. I experimented with some very, very powerful LSD. And I have to say those were, even now, you know, I'm 63 now, but even now I would say those are some of the most important and formative experiences of my life, you know. Unless you've done acid or a powerful hallucinogen, it's impossible to explain that, but if you have done it, then you'll understand it completely. And I hitchhiked around Europe after that for a couple of years, turned into a bit of a sort of wandering minstrel with a guitar on my back, and eventually had to come back because I'd run out of money, and eventually found myself into work. I started as a salesman, and I became an advertising space salesman. And I found quite quickly that I was quite good at what they called the copy close, which was where you said to a client, you know, well, I suggest we have this. We'll have a headline that says something like this, and we'll write something like this underneath. And I discovered I was quite good at that. I could come up with the words quite easily. And I drifted, because that's all it was, really. I drifted into copywriting. And there started a career in advertising. And I freelanced in the end, freelanced for most of the major advertising agencies. I set up a small company with my partner, whose name was also Peter. We were known as the two Peters, and eventually we were bought out by Saatchi's. We were one of the many little outfits that were bought out by Saatchi's, and we got involved in the big breakup. Cut a long story short, we both got sacked, and it ended in the courts, etc., etc. And boom, we were out of a job. I can't remember exactly what year it was then, but things were pretty bad. The economy was in a mess. And we sat down and said, right, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to earn a living? And, we did some very fundamental sort of analysis of market demands, and health seemed a good idea. And that was just about the time that the first reforms in the health service were coming about, when there was what was called the purchaser-provider split.
Yeah.
And it suddenly became obvious that marketing as such and communications was going to become a force in the health service. And the first thing we did was we put together a conference which was called Marketing in the Health Service. We put together any conference, we found some speakers, we did a bit of advertising, we attracted delegates. It was at the QE2 Conference Centre opposite the Houses of Parliament, so it was quite a big venue. We took a big risk, and it all seemed to be falling apart. And then in the last week before it was due to come on, we suddenly had a whole load of people from the Department of Health and other people all suddenly sign up as delegates, and it went ahead, and it was a big success. And that led to me being hired, again, cutting a very long story short, that led to me being hired as a communications advisor by a number of health authorities, a number of NHS trusts, got involved in doing annual reports for the Portsmouth and South East Hampshire Health Authority, for instance, which at the time was the biggest health authority in the country. I'd always been fascinated by technology in all its forms, and medicine was another, as you know very well, Mike, I'm not a doctor, but I could, many people, I could find it very easily to convince many people that I was, that I am, because I'm just fascinated by detail. And all the time this was going on, I was continuing to smoke cannabis, continuing to be outraged at the way the law tried to impose on me. And eventually, in 1983, I heard that there was a Home Affairs Select Committee inquiry into what they termed dangerous drugs, and particularly the cultivation of cannabis. And I thought, well, I'm going to submit something. So I sat down and wrote this report called An Unaffordable Prejudice. I drew on a lot of books that I'd read, in particular one called The Strange Case of Pot by a chap called Dr. Michael Schofield. It's out of print now, but it was very influential on me. And I submitted the report, and they asked me to come along to the committee and give evidence, which absolutely knocked me back. I was very exciting, and I did it, and nothing came of it.
Yes.
But there we go. And then, my career progressed, and time went on. I became more and more involved in medicine, more and more involved in medical politics as well, and writing about it. And then towards the, around about 2010, I thought, well, I began to see more and more, because I was on all this sort of, feeds for research and stuff, I began to see more and more papers demonstrating the true value of what, when I'd first got involved, was just this sort of hippie idea that, a joint a day keeps the doctor away, effectively, But I began to see more and more papers actually showing this was true, and I decided, right, I want to get involved in this. And I looked around to see, who else there was. And there wasn't anybody. The campaign was really in the doldrums. Yes. And the only people there was the Legalized Cannabis Alliance. So I made contact with them. And after that, it was just like a whirlwind. I mean, literally within a month, I was on the committee. And within about a month after that, I was elected leader. Right. And now a number of the people who were there at that time are still around. And there's a certain amount of tension there was back then, and there still is now, I surmise, between me and them, because I came in as a marketing man, and although I enjoyed a smoke as much as they did, when I first sat at a committee meeting there and they all got out their bongs and got out their skins and started rolling up and in the meeting, that wasn't what I was there for. I was really interested in doing that, but we'll do that afterwards.
Yeah.
And I very much wanted to take it forward in a sort of disciplined, you know, about marketing, communications, work out who our audience, what our audiences were, what our messages were to be. And again, cutting the story short again, we basically relaunched and rebranded the Legalised Cannabis Alliance as Clear Cannabis Law Reform.
When was that now? What year were we at?
That was 2011. That actually And I mean, one of the main thoughts behind that was that we wanted to move away from the word legalise, because legalise was and still is interpreted to mean a free for all. Whereas, in fact, of course, what we want and what we all want in this is more control. In fact, not less control. Yeah. We want more control. So, Clear Cannabis Law Reform was the name. Mm. The clear bit came stupidly. It came from CLR, Cannabis Law Reform. Somebody said clear, and we said, and somebody said the truth about cannabis is clear, and then that was it.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
So that's where it came from. There was a lot of bad feeling about the rebranding, although it was done with the membership. You know, it was all done through ballots with the membership, and they approved it all and everything. The old guard, as it were extremely unhappy about it. The previous, objectives and sort of manifesto had been half an inch thick, 50 pages maybe. I knew, because I am a professional communicator, I knew that didn't work. And so we got it down to five objectives, principal one of which was, as a matter of urgency, permit the prescription of medicinal cannabis by doctors. That was always our primary goal. And I think the first one was end the prohibition of cannabis, the second one was permit the prescription of medicinal cannabis, and the third one was implemented a system for the regulation and supply of cannabis to adults. It's not revolutionary stuff, and certainly isn't now, at least.
But it's really important to have clear points, isn't it, rather than ramblings.
Exactly,
because that just doesn't help.
We've just seen, and I'm not going to mention any names at this stage, we've just seen another organisation set up produce a manifesto or a report, which I know has had on contributions from the people who are in the old guard of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance. And whilst I don't disagree with anything they say in their report, they're going to hate me for this and I'm going to be attacked again, but I don't disagree with anything they say. I'm afraid just the way they go about doing it, they've got this idea they want to get the foundation evidence as to why cannabis was made illegal in the first place. Well, I can sympathise with that, and there isn't any foundation evidence, but I mean, that's not going to get us anywhere, because the Misuse of Drugs Act is an act of Parliament.
It's there.
It exists. Yes. And the only way we're going to change it is by MPs changing it.
Absolutely.
And when in 2011, when we relaunched as Clear, there were Peter Lilly was one Tory MP who was on side. I can't think of a Labour MP who was on side at the time at all. In fact, I can't think of another MP now apart from Peter Lilly. It was definitely fewer than a handful of MPs who were on side.
So do you think, Labour has not covered themselves in glory in this campaign. You'd think they're the more than natural home, in a sense, for broadening the cannabis debate, but they haven't been. Why do you think they haven't been? It's an odd...
Well, I mean, that gets into broader politics, and I mean, one of the other reasons why I was unpopular with the old guard was I was looked upon as a Tory. Yeah. And the idea that a Tory should get involved in cannabis law reform, it's like this stupid idea that if you believe in this thing, if you're pro-choice, shall we say, or pro-life, then if you adopt one of those positions, then you have to adopt the other positions to go along
party,
with it, and you're not allowed to hold that position.
Yes. Yeah.
But I mean, that's never been me.
Well, I don't think it's actually many people. I think most people probably have an array of thoughts across the whole political spectrum. People just have to vote where they think they're most fit. But I think you're absolutely right, Mike, that I know that some families actually tried to speak to the leader of the Labour Party before the last election, and actually one of them did speak to him at a conference, and I feel saddened that they didn't take it on more and promote it being, but there are some really great outspoken Labour MPs such as Tony Antonetti.
There are now.
But as you say, in 2011, there
the good thing about the campaign is actually it's very cross-party. Tories now, let's say Mike Penning is one, for example, and there are others, Crispin Blunt, of course. You expect, in a sense, just to put them in a box, you expect the Greens and the Lib Dems to be on side, and they are. But we had support from the SNP, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Even I say this, I don't know if it's going out widely or not to Northern Ireland, but even the DUP have been
supportive of their particular
constituents.
Right.
So it's been very cross-party, interestingly.
It doesn't
fall along standard party lines.
I mean, to come back to your question as to why I think the Labour Party wasn't in those days involved was because, and this is where I get into border politics, because I do think that socialism is inherently more authoritarian, and it's more about laying down rules which people have to abide by. And so I don't think, and then if you look at the history of the Labour Party and what it's done on all drugs policy, you know, I mean, the most obvious and famous example, of course, is Alan Johnson sacking David Nutt. But I mean, you know, even after that, we had Jackie Smith, you know, who disgraced herself as well, but has since apologised, and so she now realises she did the wrong thing on cannabis. David Blunkett, even before her, David Blunkett was the Home Secretary when the amendment to the Misuse of Drugs Regulations was enacted, which made it a criminal offence for doctors to prescribe cannabis.
Which you... I can't believe that, because obviously that was when I was growing up as a child, and I didn't realise that, but I always saw that Labour Party as being quite moderate, but actually it wasn't.
Because, I mean, you could still get cannabis tincture in pharmacies. I believe you could still, I don't know where I've got this figure now from, but I've researched it in the past, I believe you could still give it up to 1973.
Okay.
Yes.
And I'm not quite sure why that was, because the misuse.
No, I thought it was 71, but you're right. It's certainly to the early 70s.
Yes.
And I don't know why.
Yeah. And doctors were allowed to prescribe it, even though it would become a Class B drug. Technically, a doctor could still prescribe it. So David Blunkett actually introduced this law
to stop it
and made it a criminal offence.
Which is incredibly sad. Yeah. So what do you feel now, the sort of state of medical cannabis in the UK? Obviously, we've had legalisation to prescribe 2 years ago. We have 3 prescriptions now on the NHS for whole plant cannabis and around 2,000 private prescriptions. What do you feel about that, and what do you think needs to happen to change the access?
Well, I've rather changed my view in some ways recently, because I've always been opposed. When I first got involved, the cannabis world was full of conspiracy theories, and you know, the big pharma conspiracy theory being the main one. And I resisted that, because I always felt, you know, well, if pharmaceutical companies, and we knew even then that pharmaceutical companies were looking at cannabinoids, I thought that if pharmaceutical companies can develop cannabis or cannabinoids to a point where it becomes a successful medicine, they'll be only too happy to make medicines from it, etc. And you know, all my experience of life tells me that where you think it's a conspiracy, it's much more likely to have been a cock-up in the first place.
Yeah,
that's what you say a lot.
I totally agree with that. I don't believe in cock-up rather than conspiracy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. But of course, what happens then, of course, I mean, as we're seeing today in another context, is cock-up gets made and then it has to be covered up.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem arises. Now, now, having said all that, back up to date.
Yeah,
I am horrified at the conflict of interest, the financial conflict of interest between the doctors who are writing these guidelines. Well, the guidelines, which
the prevention of access.
They basically say no, you can't do this. I mean, Professor, you know, he can sue me if he wants to. Professor Finbar O'Callaghan says in his personal biography that his principal career interest is running clinical trials.
Yes.
You know, so if a pharmaceutical company wants to, or a cannabis company wants to run a clinical trial on paediatric epilepsy, who is one of the people they're going to consider hiring for that?
Exactly.
And therefore it's hardly surprising that he's saying, you know...
Oh, it has to be trialed before it's available.
So, you know, I mean, I've never met the man personally. I've spoken to some people who have met him who say he's quite charming personally, you know, and he probably is. But, you know, there is... it's glaringly obvious to me.
I agree there is conflicts going on, and that makes me very, very angry, being the parent of a child with refractory epilepsy who is blessed to have a prescription on the NHS.
And exactly.
That's why I work every day to try and help access for others, because I know what it's like to suffer like that, and it does grate me, and it's very sad.
And you are extraordinarily lucky. I mean, I can understand.
Yeah,
I mean, I can understand you probably have pangs of guilt about the fact that you're lucky.
And that's why I do what I do, because feel guilty.
No, I'm sure I can understand that. And of course, the other thing is that, I mean, although, you know, clearly the small child suffering epileptic fits is an incredibly emotive message, and obviously was, you know, thankfully broke the dam. But as I often say, you know, if you look across the world and all the different ways cannabis is being used, well, not only that, but pediatric epilepsy is one of the least frequently used.
Absolutely, you're right. I think the reason it worked, because as you say, it's very emotive. There's and lots of families have come forward and done amazing work on the movement of the progression of cannabis in the UK. But you're absolutely right, it's a tiny percentage, and we have to remember all the adult patients, all the people suffering with long-term chronic illness. Those people have just as much right to have access to
these medicines. All the work that Claire did through those 10 years, roughly a decade between, you know, between it being relaunched and between the law change, was on older people. And you can see all the case histories we used to put out about older people suffering intense chronic pain, generally speaking, or MS, but I mean, it all comes down to pain, really, at the end of the day. And then nothing's happened for them at all.
It's very sad.
For them at all.
What do you think needs to happen to change this sort of stalemate in the UK at the moment?
Well, I think in terms of paediatric epilepsy, because I think that is, we do need to address that, first of all. I think a special funding regime should be put in place.
Yeah,
I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
I mean, what it would cost is absolute chicken feed.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, it is.
I mean,
compared to the money they're spending at the moment.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
I mean, secondly, as we've talked before, the other thing that needs to happen is we need to have a domestic cannabis production industry.
Absolutely.
Agreed. Yeah.
And,
yes.
I mean, that's what I actually spend, well, you know, everything's completely different, isn't it, in the last 6 to 9 months. But I mean, that's what I was spending all my time on, because effectively the main objective of our campaign had been fulfilled, you know, cannabis. And the other thing, which a lot of people don't understand, although they find it outrageous when I say it, is that the UK has probably the most flexible system for prescribing medicinal cannabis anywhere in the world.
I keep saying that. It is one of the most liberal regimes globally.
Exactly.
And I think sometimes the campaigners attack the wrong bodies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all Matt Hancock is evil. Actually, I think it's the wrong target. I know Hannah doesn't totally agree with that, but I think the real target is the hierarchy medical profession.
Yeah, absolutely. The medical establishment.
That's who we need to get.
Exactly.
I do agree with that, but I also think that he could put measures in place, i.e. education. They could look at legislation for allowing GPs to prescribe.
There are things he can do.
He refuses to do. He's
under pressure from the medical establishment.
He's got it both ways.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there's nothing can forgive saying on camera, you'll have it in the normal way within a few months, and then we're
in
still
March
here now. You know, I mean, he's a minister of the Crown.
He's not by any means perfect. Don't get me wrong.
He cut through it like that.
Of course he could.
But I still think the brunt of the campaign should be against the medical hierarchy, who are so entrenched, so conservative.
Exactly.
Maybe
not
some
putting the
corrupt,
patient first.
Not putting the patient. I thought being a doctor was to.
It is corruption.
Was to do the best for the patient, and not best for yourself, best for your career, or best for your hospital hierarchy. So I think a lot of doctors, senior doctors, have just got it all upside down.
And it's not just failing to do the best for the patients. It is actually, particularly in paediatrics,
doing harm.
It's doing harm.
Yeah, they are doing harm.
Yes.
You
know,
absolutely.
It's bizarre.
It's disgraceful. I mean, you know,
it is disgraceful.
It's unbelievable. So as I said, I mean, I think my perspective has changed my view in some ways, in that I think there is a conspiracy or an establishment inertia, which is what we need to break.
We do.
And I don't know how to do that.
I was going to ask you, how do we do that? Is Clear still, we come back to Clear for a moment, what's Clear's objective now?
Well, our objective now is more about general. I mean, I think what we'd like to see now is general legalisation. We're more interested in that now. And I think that may be
decriminalisation. So you're not interested in decriminalisation, because there's a lot of talk between legalisation and decriminalisation, and I'm really interested on your view on that.
Decriminalisation, I think, is a dangerous halfway measure.
I agree with that.
I think that it may, it's okay if it's a stepping stone.
Mm.
There's two types of harm that come from cannabis. There's health harms and there's social harms.
Mm.
And so the social harms vastly outweigh the health harms in all but a tiny, tiny fraction of a percentage of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal social harm is the harms of the criminal market.
Mm.
And if you decriminalise, you actually make it easier for them.
You're not protecting anyone,
are you? No, you're actually making it easier for the gangsters.
Exactly. No, I agree.
This is what has been said in New Zealand now, isn't it? They're saying that there's been a push to now we should decriminalise. Jacinda Ardern has said she doesn't want to see people criminalised for using cannabis, which neither do I, obviously neither do any of us.
Mm.
But as they've also said in New Zealand, you know, the proposal they put forward was about exactly that.
Mm.
It was about removing the harms of the criminal market, and decriminalisation doesn't do
it. Doesn't do that, absolutely.
On the other hand, you can't keep on destroying people's lives. I mean, I'm very fortunate. You know, I'm 63. I've consumed cannabis virtually on a daily basis for 50 years. And I've never... I've never been caught in this country with cannabis.
Mm.
I have been in another country, which I'm not going to mention.
You left quickly.
I don't have a record for that, so it hasn't ruined my life in that sense.
No.
But I mean, just having a record.
It can.
Exactly.
I mean, you see, there's Philip Bevington, isn't there? He's an 80-year-old man using cannabis for liver failure, and he's due in court. And I just think that's utterly disgraceful.
It's an obscenity.
It's absurd.
Yes.
There's no other word for it.
Your journey in the cannabis world, from smoking it to becoming an advocate, what do you think it's taught you about yourself?
Oh, I've learnt an awful lot of lessons from it.
Mm.
I think it's taught me to be more, I mean, it may not seem like it from some of the things I've just said, but it's taught me to be more politic and be more careful about what I say. It's taught me that if you get attacked, I think this is a lesson which all, because I mean, I was a sort of politician for a while.
Mm.
I mean, we were a political party for a while. I stood in the Corby by-election in 2012. You know?
Mm.
We have to, if you get attacked, don't attack back.
Yes.
And
it takes a lot of practice.
It does, yeah. You know, I was subject to a horrendous trolling campaign for about 3 years.
How did that affect you?
Deeply.
Yeah.
I mean,
you've got this external persona, if I might say so, of not giving a damn. But actually, that consistent attacking...
Oh, deeply.
It does hurt.
It's very sad.
Yeah. I mean, I was literally frightened to turn my computer on for a while.
Yeah.
Because I knew every time I turned it on, there would be streams of invective... stories about me doing this story. I mean, I've been accused of everything from being a paedophile, an anti-Semite. You know, there's still a website about me. I mean, I'm sure you know about it.
Yes.
The Peter Reynolds Watch website, which is hosted in Iceland. So there's nothing I can do about it. And I mean, the last story on that, all the stories are fictitious or just exaggerations of things. But the last story on that is about me meeting an MS patient to interview her and sexually abusing her. And I mean, it's just completely invented. You know, there's not a hapless of truth in it.
Yeah.
And yet there were in the past. There were plenty of people out there who were prepared to believe these things.
That's incredibly sad.
And you know, there's pictures, photocop pictures of me with cocaine all over tables and me lying around looking thoroughly dishevelled, and it's just awful. You know.
Why do you think you've generated that reaction in some people? What do you think would you have changed what you've done in the past to have you to smooth it off a bit? What do you think has generated that sort of almost hate campaign?
Well, it was a hate campaign. Yeah. I think it was a number of things. I think it was partly because I was being successful. There was a time when Claire was the loudest and most prominent voice in the campaign. It's also because there was a real antipathy towards me for being a Tory. And there was a lot of antipathy towards me for the fact that I had, in quotes, destroyed the previous work that had been done in the Legalised Cannabis Alliance.
Hmm. Yes. I think it's very sad, and it's the one thing, obviously, I've experienced. I'm very new to this.
Mm.
You know, I started off just trying to help Alf be okay, and then I've been thrown into this world that I feel very passionate about. It's really important to me, but I'm very new to it, and I accept that. But there is a lot of ego, a lot of anger, a lot of aggression. And I find it really sad because actually we all want the same thing
exactly.
at the end. We all want access to be there. We want people who are chronically ill to be safe and to be as well as they can be. And actually, we don't all have to agree. We don't have to agree, but we can. I think there's a huge amount of judgment. I've heard so much gossip about people that they did this and they did that. And
the cannabis space is its own worst enemy sometimes, because we're all basically heading in the same direction. It's all different angles.
I remember Peter Carroll said that to me from Endopain. He said, the one thing governments like the best are campaigns that fall out. And it's so
true.
Because these people are spending all this time arguing with each other. Actually, they're not doing anything effective. Yeah. It's just like, it's just have respect, drop the ego, get rid of the judgment. And social media doesn't help with that either, because people say things on social media they would never dare say to your face.
Absolutely. I sought medical help eventually about my because I really and I went to counselling, and I went to about 6 counselling sessions, and it did help. It helped a great deal, you know. I mean, I can remember, you know, I'm probably well known for having dogs as well, and I can remember in the height of it, I would take my dogs for a walk, and I'd go out with them in the morning, and I'd typically walk for an hour and a half every morning, and I would suddenly be back home, and I'd missed what was going on all the time, because my mind was just churning and going on and on and over what had been said, you know, and it was horrendous. You know, you learn how to cope with it. You do learn I was too reactionary to start with. I did kick back too hard at people. Some of the time, the best thing you can do is just do nothing.
Exactly. Yes. Ignore it, rise above it.
I think we've learned that. Just ignore it. Difficult though it is, just ignore
exactly. I mean, I think the other thing that really drove me was that, although, as I said right at the beginning, I was always very outraged that the law tried to impose on my personal freedom to consume cannabis, when I began to meet people personally who had conditions that were helped by cannabis, that's what really fired my determination and my passion. Because I'm going to continue to consume cannabis for the rest of my life, whether the law changes or not. It's not going to have any impact on me. You know, even if they lock me up, which thankfully is unlikely these days for consuming cannabis, but even if they were to lock me up, it wouldn't stop me.
You get a better choice.
I don't think so. synthetics only.
Yeah.
That's what has really driven me, and it's fantastic that it's been achieved. And I think that, you know, in 5 years' time, a lot of it is just a question of time.
I was going to go on to that next. How do you feel about the future in the UK? Where do you think it's going?
I do believe that we have the potential. I think you said it in your article. Was it in the Standard or the article?
Independent.
The Independent,
the Weekend,
right. You said, you know, Britain should be a leader in the medical cannabis industry,
absolutely.
And it can be.
Yeah.
And I mean, as I was touching on earlier, I've now... they're all on hold now for obvious reasons, but I had a number of clients who were looking to pursue licenses, both in the UK and Ireland. I've become very deeply involved in understanding exactly what is required in that. Again, there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. In this particular instance, the Home Office are not the biggest obstacle, because all the Home Office is interested in is security and preventing what they call diversion. And what you have to do is convince the MHRA, first of all, that that you can do this properly. The standards the MHRA require are the standards that might be applied to, another phrase I use, to weapons-grade nuclear material. You know, I mean, that's the way that they treat cannabis.
Yeah.
So I think these standards are too high. But, I mean, when you get doctors like, you know, the great Chris Whitty, you know, who the whole country is looking to for leadership now, when you consider he was the one who said a few months back that cannabis could be the next thalidomide.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most ridiculous statements
of
somebody who's meant to be intellectual.
Exactly.
We haven't used it for 5,000 years and 163 million people use it every day. I think we might know if it's the next thalidomide.
Exactly.
About 5,000 years ago.
I think what makes me very angry about that, and other parents that I know as well, is that a lot of anti-epileptic medication that's used doesn't have specific randomised controlled trials in children. They're always prescribed off-label or sometimes unlicensed for that indication, and that's done freely. You know, I've seen clobazam be dished out to children who are under 6 years old, like Smarties. It's an addictive benzodiazepine.
Yeah.
And when Alfie was prescribed it, no one said to me, this is an addictive drug, he should only be on it a short amount of time. He was just put on it, and there was no informed consent, let's say. There was no, I didn't understand it. And yet they talk about cannabis like that. Yet, why aren't we talking about all the other medications that our children are given? They're horrendous drugs, and yet they're dished out willy-nilly. And that, I mean, that sort of mindset is conditioning, isn't it? It's like, oh, it's okay because it's a pharmaceutical drug. Well, no, it's not okay.
My youngest son lost his left hand in a car accident when he was 17. And he was on OxyContin and benzos, and he found the benzos much more difficult to deal with, getting rid of.
They're very, very hard. And once you're on them, they take years to come off them, because the, especially for children with epilepsy, because actually they cause rebound seizures when you withdraw them, and it's not because your epilepsy is getting worse; it's because you're having rebound seizures from the withdrawal, and that's they can cause organic brain changes. You know, they're very, very dangerous drugs,
and they're
used very, very, very easily with no real understanding from parents about what they are.
So this is another instance where the medical establishment is fundamentally failing people.
Absolutely.
By completely distorting the relative harms.
I think the problem is, I mean, my mum used to be a chief executive in the NHS when she was working and in Sussex, and the pharmaceutical companies have a really big stake in the education of doctors, and that's the biggest problem, because that's why plant medicines aren't talked about, botanical medicines. And as Mike says, botanical medicines are what we had before pharmaceuticals came. They have a place in the toolbox of doctors, but they're not, because of pharmaceutical companies. And I know that if steroids weren't here, my son wouldn't be alive. So I'm not vilifying pharmaceuticals at all.
Of course not. You can't do
but
it.
They shouldn't be used to live necessarily if there's other drugs that have less harmful side effects are available, like botanical medicine.
Yeah.
That's the problem. They have such a big stake in the NHS.
The trouble is that the people, I know, particularly since getting involved in the CBD industry, I know a number of the people at the MHRA, and I mean, they're good people, but I mean, they've all come from the pharma industry. Mm. Botanical medicines are much more complex than single molecule pharmaceutical medicines, so it's, in a way, it's much easier, it is much easier to test than the botanical medicines, but you have to put the risk in proportion.
Absolutely, and if you've got a child having hundreds of seizures a day, or you give them a whole plant cannabis product which stops their seizures, but you say, but we haven't got randomised controlled trials. Well, who cares? Because the benefit is there. Yeah. It's very obvious. That child is evidence. It's not anecdote. It's evidence because they're not having hundreds of seizures every day. And actually, the risk of seizures far outweighs the possible risk of a botanical medicine being used. And that sort of holistic approach to individualised patient care just isn't there.
And the idea that you should force that child to stop taking the whole plant cannabis in order to put them through, that should
disgusting.
Be a criminal offence.
Exactly. It's absolutely disgraceful.
Putting the child's life in danger.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Still lots of work to be done.
To a large extent, time will be what makes this right.
Definitely.
We'll get there.
We'll get there.
Another 30 years of your time and we'll be sorted out, Peter. So finally, what came back to you? You've moved to Ireland. How do you find that? Why?
Why is purely and simply property prices.
Yeah.
I found myself, my parents died. I was left a small inheritance. I've passed two previous houses that I owned to two previous wives.
Do you like wedding cake?
And I recognised the fact that I was either going to be, my parents didn't leave me enough to buy me the sort of house in which I'd like to live, or at least not in the UK. And I recognised I was either going to be renting my home for the rest of my life, effectively, or I was going to have to move somewhere where I could take, a small amount of savings. I had the legacy my parents had left me. And so I bought a small farm in Ireland that is in the middle of nowhere.
Sounds lovely.
That was 20 minutes from the local airport from which you could fly to London every day. That's all changed now, of course.
Yes. But do you enjoy it?
I love it. I absolutely adore it. I mean, everybody warned me about the climate, and they were right and I was wrong. It does rain an awful lot. But, it's... it's my own world. It's entirely my own world. In completely, and I adore it. And there is another campaign to be fought, because the Irish position is... I'm very conscious of the fact that although I've lived there 3 years now, I'm not Irish. But I am now involved with Garrett McGovern, Vera Toomey,
Good.
Tom Curran. Good people. Yes.
Yeah, Vera's amazing. We live down the road from each other in Holland by mistake.
Well,
and she's become a very good friend of mine. She's brilliant. She's an amazing woman.
Yeah. Alicia Maher and Claire McAfee.
Yeah.
We are setting up the Irish Medicinal Cannabis Council.
Brilliant.
Really
which,
good.
Which is, yeah. which is intended basically because there isn't anything like that.
No, it does not. Yeah. And they were up to a few years ago. I think they were getting there more quickly than we were in the UK with the campaigns by people like Gino Kenny and such.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah.
And it sort of faltered. It's gone into the doldrums.
Ridiculous. I mean, in fact, the Irish medical establishment is even worse.
Mm. Yes, it's difficult to envisage that anyone could be even worse.
Well,
it's true.
I mean, they're unbelievable. Yes.
You know, that's really exciting news, and I'm really glad about that because I think Vera she's done amazing work in Ireland on her own,
pretty much,
with, you know, no campaign groups, no nothing, and she's achieved some amazing stuff, but I think she does feel quite lonely and isolated, so it's amazing that you're coming together as a group to do
something. The whole story was completely blanked by RTE, the Irish National Broadcaster.
I know.
They did not cover it at all.
And she's an amazing woman, so that's really good. That I'm really pleased to hear that. So fine.
We better stop. We've gone on much longer than we thought, but that's because you've been so entertaining and interesting.
So interesting.
And we wish you all the best, not only living in Ireland, but with the Irish campaign. And if we can help with that, we're glad to do
well, so. Well, I'm actually not putting myself forward as a member of the council, specifically because I'm not Irish.
No.
But I'm going to be the secretary.
Oh, good.
So I'm going to be behind the scenes.
It's great news.
Well, all the very best with
all
that,
the
Peter.
Best with
and
it.
Thank you very much for coming across to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you. And I've really enjoyed listening to your personal story because I've known, obviously, who you are for the last 2 years, but I haven't got to know you. So I feel like I've got to know you a little bit. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
My pleasure.
Thank you.